There we go. Thanks. If I remember last week, it never got on. So anyway, I wanted to talk about something I think about a lot, and that's really about the way the words we read, the words we hear, the words people say things to us, the way we think in our mind, you know, actually affect the way we see the world, maybe the way we think about Buddhism. You know, it's something I've thought about just for years and years. And I started to think about Buddhism. And when I say Buddhism, I'm thinking about spirituality really kind of really in a large way. I started in high school. This was kind of the late 1950s, believe it or not. Jack Kuryak's books had just come out. And one was On the Road. Another was Dharma Bums. And, you know, now when we read those books, and there are a lot of books about those books, and we realize that these were just a bunch of drunken louts, right? but at the time, you know, they gave an image, you know, really of a breaking out of, you know, some customary way of life. And this was about the time everyone was talking about the man in the gray suit, if that was the name of the book. And the fact that we grow up, we have jobs, we're kind of constrained, that, you know, we never think more broadly, for example, than we might. And so for me, those books were very important. And about 10 years ago, I went back to read them again, and I looked at them and I says, you know, the books had changed, or I had changed, but when you're a kid, they're really important. And then I picked another book up by Somerset Maugham called The Razor's Edge. He was my favorite author when I was in high school and a young guy. And he talks about a man growing up in Chicago you know, great fame and fortune and a great job. And he decides at the end to remain a taxi driver. Because he wants to have immediate experience and live in a world in which he can be completely himself. And, of course, I didn't understand at the time what he was talking about, but it truly touched me. And then in 1958, John Blofield's book came out and called The Zen Teachings of Wang Po on the Transmission of Mind. And I figured the transmission of mind, you know, that whatever that was, whatever it meant to me at the time, you know, it seemed to have a promise, you know, to be something more. And so this is really how I started on the Zen trail. I came here in 1976. The building had been purchased some months before, so I wasn't part of the original group. 1977, Katagiri Roshi said, you're going to attend the session. That's the way he talked. You're going to be part of the session. And I said, so how long is it? And he said, 7 days. And now we worry about, can I do a morning? You know, can I do a day? You know, what about how many years do I have to work at it before I can do a weekend? And he said, 7 days, you know. And so during this session, you have work periods. And during work periods, you're not supposed to talk. It's supposed to be mental absorption. I mean, you're really mindful. But, of course, we all talk. And the guy I was working with one day leaned over and he said to me, what other self-help things have you tried? What other self-help things have you tried? And given my background, I was really stunned. You know, I was stunned. Self-help things. You know, I was going to transform my mind, right? And it got me to think about why people come to the Zen Center, how we think about it, you know what I mean? How we understand the words we use. And, of course, the words we hear and the words we use are a reflection of the way we think in our mind. So they're extremely important. And Buddhism is very much about watching the mind, right? The words, the mind. Your words, your understandings reflect your mind, okay? And so I've thought about this for years, I was influenced. Oh, some years ago, we had a Zen teacher from Oregon, Jan Cowens, Bays is her name, and she works with the Zen community of Oregon. And she gave a great talk, and she talked about having little people on each shoulder. And in Zen, there's a famous bodhisattva kind of negative one called Mara. And during the Buddhist night of enlightenment, during the second watch, when as he was becoming enlightened, of course, the last challenge is temptation, right? Your own temptation. And this is Mara. And there's Mara sitting up there saying, you can't do it. Why do you want to do it? And if you read the Buddha's enlightenment, then, Mara is very strong. So here on this shoulder, we have Mara telling us all the time, why sit? Buddhism is a cult. You know what I mean? things like this. Let's go have a cup of coffee. We don't have to sit in a second sitting. Or we don't have to come and listen to a Dharma talk. On this shoulder, you have a bodhisattva of your choice. And up in the seal up here, this is Manjushri. And a bodhisattva is really a kind of a Buddhist figure, a personification, basically, of right view, right understanding. And there are all kinds of different bodhisattvas. Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of loving kindness, for example. And if you're green, you can have green para sitting there, whoever you want sitting up there. And this is a conversation that goes back and forth. Mara's saying, don't do it, you can't do it, why read, etc. Over here, I'm going to use Manjushri, who, by the way, happens to be the bodhisattva of wisdom. And he usually has a sword, and the sword is to cut through delusion, or if I can say the nonsense, basically, that you get from Mara over here. And one reason I think that's really a useful way to think about the conversation that goes on in your mind is because it produces some distance. You know, there's some distance between you and those thoughts that come up. You know, it's easy to confuse yourself with your thoughts. And you think, I am my thoughts. But if you can sit back and observe your thoughts, you're not your thoughts. I'll mention later that our brain basically is a thought generator. That's its job. You can't. The idea that you sit in meditation in Zazen, and in some sense no thoughts come up, that you're just in plain emptiness, it's not the way it works. As you find out. Usually when you're a beginning meditator, and you think, I'm going to sit in a, this is called the Zafu, this is the Zabutan. So I'm going to sit, and serenity is just going to wash over me. And instead what happens, you run into what's called the waterfall experience, the worst thing you want, the waterfall experience. And that means that you have not, you're not, most of us don't think of observing our mind. You know what I mean? We think we are the thoughts that come up, and we don't think about sitting back and listening to the conversation that goes on. Okay? And so what happens when you start to do it, a great rush of ideas come in, good and bad, and you're ready to jump up from the cushion and say, this is not what I wanted. So that's the waterfall experience. And so we're not used to really listening to our mind. And again, if you think about having this conversation, Manjushri over here, Mara over here, remember your mind just generates these kind of thoughts, etc., and it produces some kind of distance. Well, in Buddhism, we have advice, if I can, or guidelines, if I can use those terms, that are called skillful means. And I wanted to just present a few skillful means to help us really deal with these thoughts. And if you look at the title of what I'm talking about, I call it, is Buddhism, basically half empty? Is the bottle half empty? You know, you can look at it in a very negative way, or is it half full? And I like the idea of half full, no pie in the sky, no pie in the sky. The bottle is still half empty, right? But it's also half full. Okay? And so that's what we're going to talk about, because to me, the very thoughts we use to think about Buddhism, we can sit every morning, and we can sit in our cushion, we can wear robes, we can go through ordination, we can do all of this, etc. 40 years can go by and nothing happens. Absolutely nothing happens unless we use right view and we develop right view and we understand basically what we're trying to do as best we can. Okay? And that's what we're going to talk about. So we call these kind of guidelines, we call them skillful means in Buddhism. There's a word called upaya. I'm not going to give you a lot of Buddhist words, but some skillful means, if you will. One of the skillful means is to learn to recognize and identify these bottles half-empty thoughts as they arise. You know what I mean? That if we don't watch our thoughts, you know what I mean, and they just arise, oftentimes we're not aware of how negative we think, if I can use the word negativity, how negative, how dark, if you will, that we tend to think. And I usually think of those words, if you're a journalist at the university and you're learning your trade, they'll say, take this story and give it a very dark interpretation. You know what I mean? And so you use words that have connotations of really glumness, sadness, pain. They can say, take the same story and give it a happy turn, or at least an upbeat turn. You know what I mean? And so we want to think about our terms. We're the journalist student. You know, what words are we choosing? You know, are they the gloomy words? Or are they forward-looking words, if you will? So the very first kind of skillful means is to learn to listen and recognize and be aware when these kinds of less than helpful images come up in what we read, what we hear, and what we think. And I want to give you some examples. And I'm going to do this using some ideas from the Four Noble Truths. And if you're not familiar with this, this was part of the Buddha's first teaching. After the Buddha became enlightened, the Buddha went to find individuals he had practiced with, and he talked about the Four Noble Truths, the Middle Way, things like this. So this is one of the most very basic of the Buddha's teaching. The first of the Four Noble Truths is life, I'm going to put it my way, life is suffused with suffering. Life was suffused with suffering. And so there's that word suffering. And I picked up, I went to the library, Monica's library, and I went through I went through a lot of books, and maybe four out of every five books and used the word suffering and had kind of a bottle's half empty interpretation of what that meant. What they said basically was, not just life was suffering, but it was full of pain. It was full of sorrow. So remember, we're the journalism student. You know what I mean? And we're using those kinds of dark words, right? And that's the image we have. But you can also look at suffering in a different way. And if you read the Buddha's writing, the Buddha just wasn't talking about the gloomy part. Bad things happen to everybody, right? Bad things happen to everybody. My dad died when I was a baby, and my mother raised four kids. You know, my wife and I lost a daughter in her mid-20s. My brother died 10 years ago of cancer. Everyone you talk to, it's just part of being human, right? Etc. And we all have to have that in here. But what the Buddha was talking about was change. And in fact, you can have the most money, you can have the best job, you can have the ideal family, you can be the brightest, any of that, and it doesn't last. And one of the marks, basically, of a human being in the world in general is impermanence. Everything changes. You're going to lose it. Okay? The Buddha talked about suffering in that sense. He was talking about this broad aspect of life that we all have, regardless of how successful in some kind of a modern sense. And so this is what he meant by suffering. And so you can see how you look at that first noble truth. Life is suffused with suffering. You can look at it in this very gloomy way. Or you can just look at it. This is a condition of life. We all have it. Everyone has it. The second noble truth has to do with the cause of suffering. And in fact, the four noble truths are based upon an old problem-solving pattern in India. The first part says, what's the problem? And the second part says, what's the cause of the problem? And the third part says, is there a solution? and tells you a little bit about it. And then the fourth says, well, how do you actually implement the solution? Okay? So that's what we're talking about. What's the problem? You know, why do we have dis-ease? Well, this is part of life, and that's the first noble truth. And the second is, what's the cause? So I look through all these books, and it says, what's the cause? And it uses words that are very dark. Grasping, greed, clinging. And anyone who's listened to a lot of Dharma talks like this or read, is familiar with that interpretation. But we can use more neutral kind of words. How about attachment? The fact is that we are wealthy. You know, we are successful. Or maybe we want to be successful and we're not quite there yet. Or whatever. And we don't want to let it go. Okay? It reminds me, and so this produces dis-ease. It produces dis-ease in us. It produces suffering in that Buddhist way. And one of my favorite images, and I like these images, is the way the people in ancient India used to catch monkeys. And that is they would get an urn, a round urn. It would have a little narrow neck, and they would put peanuts in the bottom. And the monkey would come along and put his arm in there, grab the peanuts, and, of course, formed a fist and couldn't get it out of that narrow thing. And here's this big, heavy pot. And, of course, people would come and grab the monkey. Now, all the monkey had to do was let go of those peanuts, right? And the monkey could take its arm out, right? But it can't. It won't. It wants. It really is attached to those peanuts, etc. And so if we think of it that way, this is part of the human condition. That as we grow up, as individuals, we're taught, you know, basically to want certain things, to be a certain kind of person. This is how we should act. This is how we should look. And if we don't quite meet those cultural ideals, but we still cling to them. We still cling to them, and we feel dis-ease if we don't actually get there. So basically, these are the first two noble truths. And again, you can think of suffering in this kind of very negative way. You know, life is pain. And I think of that person when I was here for my first session who leans over and says, what other self-help things have you tried? And so people have actually said to me, well, people come to the Zen Center because they have problems. They wouldn't be here otherwise. You know, they have psychological or addictive problems or whatever. And so you start seeing the Zen Center and Buddhist centers as that way. And I don't want to, and I have to be very careful here because I don't want to give the idea that people don't come here for those reasons and that Buddhism can't be a help. That's very important part of Buddhism. But what I'm trying to say is that's not all. And for everyone, there's more. Okay. Well, let's look at some other examples of the way things are interpreted in what we read can actually give kind of a negative or bottles half empty impression. And when you become a Buddhist, you actually take 16 vowels, if you will. I won't do this, I won't do that, etc. And I'm not going to bore you with that. You don't have to be a Buddhist to actually follow them. Because there are things that we all think about, like don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, you know, things like this, okay? So that's what I'm talking about. And the reason these are so important is because if you truly, truly develop a practice, a deep practice in what we're doing, that you really take these vowels into your very body. You know, they become part of the very, you know, you're not just thinking these thoughts, but you're living them, and they're just part of the very foundation of who you are. And so if you're taking them in kind of a negative way, it's not helpful. Okay? It's not helpful. So let me give some examples. And I'll just give three. The first is do not kill. And this, to me, is kind of a negative way to express things. And again, if you look in all those books, this is the way it's usually phrased. And what it means is that you should refrain from life-damaging violence of all kinds, etc. And for many of us, if I look around at us, etc., this is kind of a meaning that we don't kill, right? I mean, that's not something that we... But that's something that we typically don't engage in. Okay. Thich Nhat Hanh, and I don't want to talk about books too much, but Thich Nhat Hanh in many books, but particularly the Heart of Buddha's Teaching, just a wonderful book. I use it when I teach a mid-level course, etc. He looks at these very same precepts, and he reinterprets them. What he thinks is closer to what the Buddha meant. And so here's what he says for do not kill. He says, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning new ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. He's not talking about don't, do not, you know, all those words. If you have kids and you really try to be a good parent, you learn not to say do not, you know what I mean? But instead you say something positive, okay? What he's saying is not just don't kill, but protect, actively protect, not just other human beings, other animals, plants, and the whole life. So he's telling us to reach out, with compassion and loving kindness. So again, we go from do not kill. And again, if we sit with our precepts and we sit there on our mat every morning with those precepts and we're thinking of do not kill, just think what a difference it means if you say protect the earth. Look at everything around you, animals, plants, the very ground and sod around you, etc. Look at them with loving compassion. Isn't that different? Okay, let's look at another one. Now, this is do not steal. And he says, refrain from manipulating or exploiting people or from making unreasonable demands on them. So this is kind of a negative way. Don't steal. You know what I mean? And so you're stopping yourself from doing something. Don't steal. Here's Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I am committed to cultivating loving kindness and learning ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I will practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. Think of the difference. Do not steal or give, share. Okay? Again, Thich Nhat Hanh says that you know, in his view, Thich Nhat Hanh, by the way, is a famous Vietnamese Zen a Buddhist who now lives in southern France in exile and is one of the most famous Buddhists next to the Dalai Lama in the world today and numerous books. Let's look at the third one. And this is do not lie. Do not. Again, using words like when you work with your kids, do not do this. Don't do this. Okay? Instead of talking about try to tell the truth. So what he says is, aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and deep listening, in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. Okay? So here we have do not lie. But Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about deep listening. Deep listening. You know what I mean? Really being open. So again, as I started, I talked about words can create happiness or suffering. Words can create happiness or suffering. Whether we're Buddhist or not, or we're just dropping in for a classroom project or whatever, we want to learn to watch our words, to be aware of them. And I mentioned that this was our first kind of helpful guide, is to learn to listen to and identify, really recognize the nature of words and the effect they can have on us. Remember, we're the journalism student, remember? And so far, in a lot that you read in Buddhism, it sounds like the professor has said, write this story in a dark way. write this story in a dark way. Okay, and I'm convinced that remember these are Western translations of Sanskrit and Pali. You know what I mean? And so when you read the Sanskrit, it doesn't say suffering. You know what I mean? It has all kinds of connotations, and we could say disease. We could use other terms. And I'm have a Catholic background. I went to Catholic school for 4 years. Do not. I was there in the old days when you got rapped on your knuckles. And I remember the horrifying moment in my life. I still remember it. And, of course, they don't do that anymore, as far as I know. But I was caught throwing snowballs in a yard. And I must have been in third grade. And they dragged me in to see Sister Superior. And, of course, she said, put your knuckles out. So I put them out, and she took the ruler and whack, 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 you know, and really racked them. And I was just a little kid, and I'm crying, and I get shoved out in the hall of a side door. You know, there I am in the hallway crying. My friends come along. What happened? What happened? Well, I wasn't going to say Sister Superior rap my knuckles, but I said, some bully knocked me down and kicked me. And my friends grabbed me and said, let's go tell Sister Superior. Let's go tell Sister Superior. You know what I mean? So words basically, and the important thing about words, and I want to really emphasize, is that words are an extension of our thinking. Words are an extension of our thinking. And so we're always on guard. And in fact, when you meditate, one way we meditate is what's called bare awareness, shikantaza. We watch what arises, okay? And we watch for the negative thoughts as they arise, etc. We look at them as they arise, etc. And we don't try to hide from any of that, okay? And when Reb Anderson was here about 4 or 5 weeks ago for a big, we had a big retreat. We had 46 people here. Every one of the three the rooms, including the ports there, was actually lined with people. I mean, just shoulder to shoulder. And we have something called walking meditation between sitting periods where people come up and they walk in little circles. Well, you should have seen our little circle. I mean, just jammed around here, etc. But Reb Anderson talked about contemplation. He used that word a lot, contemplation. The fact that you, as these things arise, you look at them, and again, you can think about, well, are they negative? How are they hurting me? How are they stopping me from true development, which I'll talk about. Well, let me just mention a couple other skillful means that I find pretty useful. One is to realize that there will always be negative thoughts. There will always be negative thoughts. And if you look at the structure of the brain, at the very bottom back here in the base, we have the reptile brain. You know, this is a scared bunny brain, you know what I mean, that someone's going to eat you, right? And so we have all of those kind of inborn kind of things. And I was walking around the lake a week ago, and I saw a big hawk come down after some little critter. And I kept thinking, whew, at least I don't have to worry about being picked up and dragged off when I go around the lake. But for many animals, including our past, we have those basic kind of instincts. They don't go away. Safety. And then on top of that, we have the mammalian brain, right? And so you have a lot of really basic functions like food, safety, family. You know, all of these things that are part of our very genetic code. And no matter how successful we are, those thoughts come up. They're always there. They're not going to go away. And so what we want to do is we want to recognize them, see them, you know what I mean, and mark them and say, yeah, this is happening, this is arising, etc., and I understand why. Okay, and so realize that these thoughts come up, and then if we look at the Homo sapiens brain up here, we have all kinds of expectations. This is our consciousness. One thing that language does is it helps us build worlds, cultural worlds, and every cultural world has expectations, etc. And so one thing we learn in our practice, etc., is to be aware and recognize what these expectations are and how, like the monkey with that fist in the jar, we're caught, we're caught, we're caught, okay? And so we have to learn to let go. The monkey can't let go, but maybe we're going to be smarter than the monkey, and we're going to let go. And so a second kind of a useful way is to realize that, again, there will always be negative thoughts. You can sit again, I said, for 40 years. Sitting doesn't mean that thoughts cease. What changes is how you look at those thoughts, how you understand them. Okay, how you understand them. And this is why Buddhism is very, very much about the nature of the human mind. A guide is to realize, well, some of those thoughts that come up like that may have a valid point. You know what I mean? That there may be something valid. Maybe your unconscious is trying to tell you something. So it's not that you just let them go, but again, in bare awareness, you know, you observe them. You think about them. You evaluate them and see, should they be let go, or are they trying to tell me something? And if you're sitting, you don't stop then and try to solve the problem right then, but you say, later this morning, I'm going to sit down and work on this problem. Okay? There seems to be a problem. And we all have problems, right? Etc. And then the last kind of a useful way to think about these half-empty thoughts, etc., is whether they're popcorn or bubbles. I've been thinking about this. My mind is just a thought generator. It just can't stop. You know, all these ideas come up. So you can think about them as popcorn. You know, and so pop, pop, all they come up. And of course, as you get older and older, there's more and more popcorn and you're being smothered with it. And we all know that a lot of popcorn is those little hard nuggets that never pop, right? Or half-pop nuggets or something that's really horribly tasting, right? And so the older you get, you're being smothered and smothered by popcorn. And a lot of it's not very good popcorn, right? And so there you are. And I think a better way to visualize your thoughts is as bubbles. You know, they come up, you look at them, you see, are they trying to tell me something or are they just part of what I am? You know, just part of, you know, part of my organism. Worried about safety, worried about getting older, worried about change. And you recognize them and you let them go like a bubble and off they go and pop. Off they go and pop. And you can think you can practice and practice and practice there are going to be no bubbles. Doesn't work that way. They're always thoughts. They're always bubbles basically that come up. Well, let me end my part by doing two things. And I wanted to talk just a little bit about four meditations that I think are very useful bridges from thinking about yourself, which we're talking about, thinking about yourself, all your problems, to truly opening your heart mind to everyone and everything around you. I think in the front of our little brochure, we have these four meditations. They have names, of course, but we're not interested in the names. They're just four useful meditations. And they have to do with meditations on loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And if you listen to CDs by Pema Chogren, who's a very famous Tibetan teacher, she talks about these all the time as ways to bridge that kind of grayness and gloominess, etc., to opening your heart to everything that's out there. And the way these work, very briefly, is if you're doing the meditation on loving kindness, and this isn't love in our way, but it's just open your heart, you know, just joy and happiness for everyone. Okay, and the way it works is you start with somebody that you truly love. I mean, somebody you just have, you know, really like. And so when you think of that person, you say, may Barbara enjoy happiness in the root of happiness. May Barbara enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. And you just, as you sit there, and the way you would incorporate this into a meditation, if you're sitting there for 30 minutes, you might sit there and bear awareness for 10 minutes. And then for 10 minutes, you might use these meditations. And then for 10 minutes, you go back to bear awareness, okay? And so you start with somebody that you, so you have this feeling, you can really feel, what's it mean to feel real loving kindness for somebody? And then if you're brave enough, you say, yourself, may I have happiness and the root of happiness. And then you move to somebody that, who's kind of a friend, not somebody you feel compassionate about, but somebody you like, and you say that. And then you move to a person that's neutral, you don't know. The person who serves coffee in the morning at the coffee shop, or the person who drives the bus, you have no idea. And then you move to somebody who's slightly irritating. And we all have people like that. And in Buddhism, of course, they recognize as great gifts, right? Great gifts. And you say, may that rotten skunk. No, you can't put it that way, but you can say, may that person, actually have happiness and the root of happiness. And then if you're really deep into your teaching, and for many people it's very, very difficult, you think of a person you truly detest, okay? And you say the same thing. And this is the way the other meditations work, too. And the difference between loving kindness and compassion is for a person who actually has some sickness or some problem. There's something with them. You know, they have cancer. There's something problem. And then you say, may Mary be free of suffering, the root of suffering. You know what I mean? And you do this with empathetic joy, and you work through equanimity. And I'm not going to say more about those four meditations, but they're certainly something worth looking into, because they really go from yourself and your own concerns, what's my problem, etc. And they're opening to not only people you love, but to all people in the world. And at the very end, the very last thing you say for each one of these is, may everything in the world, may all beings, may all things, etc., enjoy happiness and the root of happiness. Okay, let me end by saying all of this sounds great. And we're all going to stop using gloomy words, and we're going to look at what we read and the way we think in the bottle is half full, right? And of course, every Buddhist teacher will tell you it's the easiest thing to think about. It's the hardest thing to do. It's the hardest thing to do. You can sit there and you can say, that sounds great. Every day I'm going to sit. I'm going to do those 30 minutes of meditation. The middle 10, I'm going to do these four meditations. You work on one at a time, work at a time over a number of months, etc. And you figure, wow, I'm going to sleep in. You know what I mean? I'm not going to go to the Dharma talk. I'm not going to have, you know what I mean? Some people actually are comfortable with their negative thoughts. They're comfortable with their negative thoughts. And this is one reason why you have a guide or a teacher to help you recognize and see that, if you will. So I just wanted to get the idea across that it's not an easy practice. But, on the other hand, it's incredible practice. Because as you meditate and as you reach out, you find that what's the very heart and the very core of your body, as a human being, we have loving kindness. We have compassion for all beings. And part of it is to lose our sense of self, to see ourselves just as part of the world. And sometimes I think of myself just as atoms, just as atoms, just energy. And I'll sit on the mat and I'll think of the floor, I think of the mat, I think of the wall, I think of everything. And we're all one. We're all one. We're just packaged a little different. And out of that understanding comes this great compassion. It's truly, truly incredible. And to lose that opportunity of understanding, by thinking in a bottle's half-empty way all the time, it's just limiting. And it's just something I wanted you to think about a little bit. Well, that's all I have to say. Anybody has any comments or thoughts or other guidelines, I'm happy to hear them.
This last semester I took a linguistics course, and that was very illuminating for me as you were giving your talk. A whole lot of things came up, so I'll try and condense a lot of big and abstract ideas into a couple of things here. One of them is that language and thought are intimately connected and almost inseparable. That even if even if we're not talking, things that arise have these labels that are words or vocabulary or language. And they're representations of reality. So in that regard, words are just metaphors. And it's sort of interesting that oftentimes as we sit, there's a lot of these words that sort of pop up and we get really attached to them, but they're still just metaphors, and in and of themselves, they're just labels of something bigger beyond the words themselves. One of the things that differentiates human language from other communication that exists amongst animals is that we can talk about things that are not here and now. And it's sort of interesting then that when you're sitting, you're here and now, but there's all these words or metaphors that are popping up about things that have nothing to do with what you're doing at the given moment. So that was one sort of illumination. Another thing is that language is a social phenomenon, and it's a means by which we can not just communicate, but share experiences or interpretations or perceptions of reality. And in that regard, language is a really awesome tool that we can share and distribute compassion. So in that frame, we can use it as a tool for compassion, but it seems oftentimes we use it as a tool for, you know, complaining about the weather or this, that, and the other thing.
That's right. Let's complain about the weather. Thank you very much. We had this yard sale yesterday, and miraculously the clouds parted. And then this morning I woke up and it was all rainy again. Now what Peter says is very, very important, that we can only... You read a lot in Buddhism where it says, you know, if you sit, you learn your original self. You know, you learn reality. And of course, there may be a reality behind our beyond our language structure. I'm convinced there's stuff, etc. But we only see it and only comprehend it through our representations. And the reason I make that point is our world. But if I become enlightened, whatever that means, if I see myself, what I'm seeing basically is myself within that context of representations. And so my awakening is different than the Buddha's awakening in detail, is different than any other a past Buddhist master, because they lived in different representations. And so I think this, for me, is a very important point, is that we're not going to see the world the way the Buddha saw it. But what the Buddha saw, I think, basically, is the way the world was within that structure of representations. And this is why they learn to let these things go, to watch them, to distance yourself, be the witness of these things. Because they're constructing the world around you. They're constructing the pain. And it doesn't mean you don't get old, that you don't get sick, that you don't get cancer, that you don't lose your job. But it just means that you see all of these things in a different way. So those are important points. Scott?
I see there's a lot of policing going on and checking regarding our negative thoughts, and there's struggle and battle, and there's always suggestions as to how we might soften that engagement. And so I thought of a couple of things that Alan Watts has said. He was asked, what happens when I die? And so Alan Watts put a question back and said, well, what happens to your lap when you stand up? And the other one, what happens to your fist when it opens? And so these couple of ideas suggest a sort of very easy regularization of things, just changing form, negative things, just simply changing form in a manner as simple as standing up and their lap disappears.
Thank you. Yeah.
When you were describing how, you know, an example of the glass half full and half empty, and the importance of words, I was expecting to hear you say,
That's right. Right. It reminds me of the title of a book. One of the categories, I think, second or third book. And the title is You Have to Say Something. Okay? Because one of his students, said, well, it is a matter of judgment. You know, how can you express these things in words? You know what I mean? That anything you say, anything you say sets up contrasting representations. The minute you open your mouth, there's duality, right? Right? And so the best thing would be to go off like a forest monk, you know what I mean? And just try to understand, etc. And so I think your point is a good one, and that is that we, as Katagiri says, you have to say something, and the minute you open your mouth, that you're setting up these things. And so again, half empty, half full, these things are just judgments, etc. And of course, what happens as you work with this process, what happens is that you see these as just judgments, right? You see them as just judgments, okay? You soften, Scott used the word soften. You soften the blows that you give yourself. Okay, I think we're... Thank you very much.